Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today, both presidential campaign inspired, but opening up to larger issues rather than obsessing about cephalological minutiae. In moments, Adolf Reed will tell us why he's skeptical of calls for reparations for black Americans. And Steffi Woolhandler separates fact from fiction after the Hillary camp's dishonest attacks on single-payer health insurance. First, Adolf Reed. The other day, Ta-Nehisi Coates had a piece on the Atlantic magazine's website criticizing Bernie Sanders for rejecting calls for reparations for black Americans. Sanders' comments were excessively blunt and impolitic, but was he wrong to reject the call? Adolf Reed, who's a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, has been critical of the concept for a long time. He's here to give us the long version of the answer that Sanders could have given. Randall Robinson's book, The Debt, What America Owes to Blacks, published as 2000 turned into 2001, launched a boom in talk about reparations. As that boom was taking off, Adolf Reed wrote about it in the Progressive magazine. Excerpts from that essay make a good setup for the interview. Quote, Randall Robinson's argument for the pursuit of reparations hinges explicitly on this view of the black American population as defective and in need of moral and psychological repair, and that resonates with the middle-class noblesse oblige and commitment to a racial politics that ensconces a particular guiding role for upper-status elites. Those are the people who can conduct the finely calibrated analyses that determine what forms and magnitude just compensation should take. They are the people who would stand to administer whatever compromised palliatives are likely to ensue from this activity. This also helps make sense of what has struck me as most incomprehensible about the reparations movement, its complete disregard for the simplest, most mundanely pragmatic question about any political mobilization. How can we imagine building a political force that would enable us to prevail on this issue? But the question ultimately does not arise because reparations talk is rooted in a different kind of politics, a politics of elite brokerage and entreaty to the ruling class and its official conscience, the philanthropic foundations, for racial side payments. Lest there be any doubt about the limited social vision that makes such an entreaty plausible, Robinson brushes away the deepest foundations of American inequality. And this is a quote from Robinson, "Lamentably, there will always be poverty." His beef is that black Americans are statistically overrepresented at the bottom. There's a more insidious dynamic at work in this politics as well, which helps to understand why the reparations idea suddenly has spread so widely through mainstream political discourse. And remember, this is Adolf Reed writing in 2000. We are in one of those rare moments in American history when common circumstances of economic and social insecurity have strengthened the potential for building broad solidarity across race, gender, and other identities around shared concerns of daily life. Concerns like access to quality health care, the right to a decent and dignified livelihood, affordable housing, quality education for all. These are objectives that can be pursued effectively only by struggling to unite a wide section of the American population, the substantial majority of this population, who have lost those essential social benefits or live in fear of losing them. And isn't it interesting that at such a moment, the corporate-dominated, opinion-shaping media discover and project a demand for racially defined reparations that cuts precisely against building such solidarity? And that's the end of the quote from Adolf Reed, writing in 2000. Here's an update. Adolf uses the abbreviation PMC a couple of times in his interview. It's short for Professional Managerial Class. Adolf Reed. We've got Ta-Nehisi Coates signing the call for reparations, or finding Sanders particularly guilty of hostility towards reparations. What do you think of his critique?
Well, I read the thing in The Atlantic, and I mean, it's so utterly empty and beside the point. I can't even characterize it, right? I mean, I go back to the same thing over and over again. What you can go down the Sanders platform, issue by issue, and ask, so how is this not a black issue, right? I mean, how is a $15 minimum wage not a black issue? How is public works employment, massive public works employment programs, you know, not a black issue, right? I mean, how is free college higher education, free public higher education not a black issue? And on down the line, right, the criminal justice stuff, the rest of it. So one head-scratching aspect of this is, what do people like Coates imagine is to be gained by calling the program, or calling the redistribution, racial and calling it reparations? And I don't understand that. I mean, in a way, it's the charitable or maybe just benign interpretation of what he and others imagine the power of this rhetoric to be is that there's something cathartic about it, like black power. So I'm thinking, for instance, of the, you know, say Black Lives Matter, say Sandra Bland's name, move. And it's similarly, like the demand to call it reparations doesn't seem to me to make any sense whatsoever. It doesn't add anything to a call for redistribution. In fact, if anything, it could undercut demands for redistribution because there's nothing more solidaristic than demanding like a designer program that will redistribute only to one's own group and claim that group. And by the way, whether the constituency is properly understood to be a group or a population category that the speaker wants to claim to speak for as a group. But the premise that, or the demand for a redistribution that's targeted to one group, especially at a time when times are getting tougher and economic insecurity is deepening, like for everybody, just seems like it's guaranteed not to get off the ground, and it seems almost like a police action.
I'm not Ta-Nehisi Coates, but I imagine he and people who call for reparations would respond by saying that that it's meant to address wounds that were specifically racial in their origin, starting with slavery, carrying on through Jim Crow, redlining, the structure today of the criminal justice system. These are all highly racialized injuries, and only a highly racialized remedy would be appropriate to cure it. What do you say?
Well, I think the logic fails on its own terms. I mean, my question is, look, you can grant, even for the sake of argument, that the injuries were in their origin highly and explicitly racialized. It does not necessarily follow from that the remedy has to be in the same coin. And I've not seen Coates, I haven't seen an argument from Coates about anything really, but I've not seen Coates or others who make that assertion actually argue for it, right? Give a concrete and pragmatic explanation of how that works, right? I mean, that is to say, what the response to atonement, I suppose, for past harms would look like, and what they imagine. You can tell I'm flustered. I mean, what they imagine the response would actually be, right? Because it goes from, one thing about Coates is that he kind of makes this stuff up as he goes along, right? I mean, he's, by his own account, right, he read Baldwin and got blown away and wanted to write like Baldwin, and his editor even would check him and say, look, you're writing these passages that don't mean anything whatsoever, because he's just so focused on wanting to write like Baldwin, absent having anything in particular to say. I've never gotten what seems like a cogent explanation about how this is supposed to work, right? About how the first question for me has always been, how can you imagine putting together a political alliance that would be capable of prevailing on this issue? And what you get is a lot of what black people deserve because of the harms that have been done. I just think it's fundamentally unserious politically, but I'll say this, and I'll say this as a Sanders supporter, I'll come clean on that. But the idea that Bernie Sanders becomes the target of race line activists now and not Hillary Clinton, and you might say is just beyond me, and it smells, right? Like it smells to high heaven. And yeah, you might say that, well, she's not the one who pushed through NAFTA or signed the Omnibus Crime Bill or signed that other one or ended the federal government's commitment to direct provision of income support and housing for the indigent that her husband did. But she supported all that stuff then. I just don't understand. My mind is absolutely blown about the understanding of politics that undergirds this perspective that people like Coates and TFA, proud TFA alum, DeRay McKesson and Holy Roller, and the Marissa Johnson, and all those others embrace. I mean, it's fundamentally anti-left. And, you know, the only thing you say is that this is a class program, right? Right. This is a program that expresses and connects with the interests, or the worldview, if not interests, but they do tend to come together, of an aspiring or an upwardly mobile stratum of the black and other color PMC, POC PMC, that scoffs and sneers at programs of a material redistribution, right? I mean, like when I was working in the GI movement, when people like that would come into a meeting, I just ask them, so which branch of military intelligence are you assigned to?
This sort of stuff plays very well, though, with guilty white liberals, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, a friend whom I won't out observed to me a while ago that one of the things that really, and he's a professor, but one of the things that really irks him about Coates is the way that white liberals gush over him. And my informant said that actually it strikes him of the way that upper middle class liberals fawn over the maid's son who has gone to college and made something respectable of himself.
That's pretty harsh.
Yeah, but you know, there's a lot to it, right? Because, again, like, it comes back to this question. Why should anyone pay any attention to anything that this guy says?
Well, he has a, air quotes around the word, literary writing style that appeals to certain populations.
Right. Yeah, no, I understand that. And when it's, you know, absolutely divorced from content except this funny sort of fake Candide-like thing about, you know, I'm just astounded that white people read me. It just all feels tawdry and evasive and cheap.
I was speaking with Adolf Reed, who teaches politics at the University of Pennsylvania. It's kind of hard to imagine precisely how this reparations thing would work out. If the government were to start writing checks to self-identified black people, that would, I don't know, quadruple the self-identified black population overnight. So that seems rather impractical. But I suppose you could say some variety of affirmative action would be a way of implementing it.
Well, I've heard some people argue that the pragmatic appeal of reparations talk is that it strengthens the case for affirmative action. But it strikes me, and I'm not alone in this view either, that it does just the opposite, because reparations is like affirmative action on steroids. So, and I can just imagine going to talk to a long displaced, steel worker, in Western Pennsylvania who's fretting now about, you know, further increase in economic insecurity, around the fracking stuff. And you're going to explain to him or her that, you know, because of slavery, you know, they've got to be on the giving end of some transfer payments, right, that will go to recompense blacks for harms done in the past. And, you know, again, I just, some of this stuff really just feels like a moral panic, right? And the moral panic aspect of it, it seems to me, converges on the class perspective and the career aspirations. I mean, don't forget that, right? And that kind of leaves us where we are.
Now, there are people, since Coates says this, I'm sure he's got a lot of supporters who would agree that what you're saying and what Sanders is saying represents a class-first politics that's blind to the injuries of race and the enduring damage of racism. What do you say to that?
I say that their race-first politics is a class politics. It's not an alternative to a class politics. It's a politics of a different class. It's not a working-class politics. It's an aspiring PMC class politics that's hinged in a material terms, ultimately, on race relations at administration as a career path. Well, I mean, like, there's a multi-billion-dollar diversity industry now. I mean, it might be interesting to have Ken Warren come on and talk about that, since he did a three-year tour as a, you know, deputy provost for diversity at the University of Chicago and made deep penetrations behind the lines of the corporate diversity industry.
I saw a quote from you from a piece you wrote in 2000. The Progressive magazine, I was making the rounds today on the social media, that sounds like it could have been written today. It was remarkable. But one of the points you make is that, or made then, was that whenever a universalist politics rears its head, and especially in times where, you know, the economy is quite troubled, the reparations call pops up. Now, what is one doesn't want to get too conspiratorial about this, but what were you thinking of?
Well, I mean, then, like in 2000, it really hadn't been around for a while, but it's kind of, I mean, I was out of the country for a month and came back and hadn't paid much attention to what was going on here, and came back and the reparations thing had blown way out of proportion, or had blown up. There were like conferences all over C-SPAN, Ron Coringa, Kimberly Crenshaw, and Ogletree, because it's the kind of thing that lawyers, you know, dine on. But so I was bemused. I couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. And I think I wouldn't say that it has always been. I think, for instance, when Forman and the Black Manifesto group raised the reparations notion in the late 60s, it was also connected to, you know, something like the Freedom Budget and what Whitney Young had described as a Marshall Plan for the ghetto. So in that sense, the reparations call was as much a hook that expressed Forman's cleverness maybe, or his engagement with the soapbox nationalists up in Harlem who had been talking about that kind of stuff for a long time. But definitely, I think this was really like the most extensive push of into respectable political and intellectual life for reparations at the beginning of the current century. It seemed to me that that was then it was clearly, or it seemed pretty clear to me to be a response to an alternative to the possibility that that a more universal or more class-based redistributive agenda knew a gain currency. Because part of the problem here, and I think this is a big chunk of the appeal of the reparations since 1965 or since the 1970s, is that it appeals to people whose political commitment is, first of all, to maintain the centrality of a racial interpretation of every form of inequality or injustice that affects Black people, right? So the commitment is to a race politics. And the race politics could be challenged from what they imagine to be post-racial politics, which I don't think anybody's ever talked about but them anyway, or a class politics, certainly. And what the reparations discourse does, right, is it forces a racial interpretation onto any manifestation of inequality or injustice that can be associated with Black people on the receiving end. So in that sense, the demands aren't even that important. Discussion of what the program could look like isn't even that important. The real objective, I think, is to maintain the dominance of the racialist in interpretive frame of reference. And that goes back to my contention that this is a class program, because part of the material foundation of the class has been, since the class began to take shape at the end of the 19th century, has been a claim to be representatives of the collective aspirations and the voice of Black people writ large.
And not to get too conspiratorial about this on another matter, but just looking back, you know, it seems that people like, what we're talking about, Fred Hampton or Martin Luther King, people who talk about non-racial analyses of capitalism and cross-racial alliances against it, wind up dead, and people like Karenga and Asante seem to do okay for themselves. is that just an accident, or should I be concerned about this?
I'm not sure about Asante, but we know that Karenga, knew his way to the offices of the authorities, and he knew the phone numbers, so. And yeah, look, it's easy to throw around charges of you being an agent, but and the substantivist contention that his actions were were like those of an agent, so he may as well have been an agent. And we all know where that leads. But having said all that, that strain of nationalist, I sometimes think of it as a Duvalierist politics, has always been capable of making alliances with the most dangerous and reprehensible elements of the opposition. You know, Garvey and the Klan, Elijah Muhammad and the Klan, Floyd McKissick and Roy Innes and other Black Power nationalists who created an organization in 1972 called Black Americans for a Responsible Two-Party System, or as the rest of us called it, Negroes for Nixon. And they gave the line. They all gave the same line. All the white people are racist. It's foolish to try to make distinctions among them based on principle and politics. We have to be pragmatic enough to align with whichever ones of them are going to do something for black people. And that formulation, of course, is an instantiation of the famous slippage between first person singular and plural, or first person small plural and first person big plural. That's a characteristic of nationalist ideologies, no matter where they pop up.
I remember an old slogan, black and white unite and fight. I mean, that's really...
Yeah.
Is that a pretty good guideline to political action?
Look, it doesn't have to be kumbaya, right? I mean, it's practical, right? That's what, you know, like, if you assume, right, that we are in, or that the interests and the structures that generate and reproduce inequality, dispossession, and misery are not amenable to petitions to the enlightened ruling class from one section of the oppressed, the only way that we're going to be able to make anybody's life better is to change the terms of political debate, to fight to change the terms of political debate, and we can only do that on the basis of common experience and the most broadly shared experience is, that of those of us who work for a living or are expected to work for a living. And I just don't see how we can get to any sort of better world going through any other route. And we certainly can't do it hanging out like people like McKesson and John Legend in his own mind do with, like, you know, the Broad Foundation and Bruce Rauner and TFA and people like that, right? There's a sense in which these people are like the black shock troops of neoliberalism.
That's Adolf Reed, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the third movement of Beethoven's String Quartet No. 8, one of the Rasmussenskys, performed by the Juilliard Quartet. Next, Steffi Wohlhandler. The Hillary Clinton campaign has gone from trying to co-opt Bernie Sanders to lying about him, which is a measure of his surprising success. The most egregious lie has come from Hillary and daughter Chelsea, heir to the family business, who claim that Sanders wants to take away people's health insurance, when in fact his single-payer plan would guarantee that everyone was covered and covered well. Steffi Wohlhandler is a primary care physician, a professor at the City University of New York, and co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. Working with their partner, David Himmelstein, they've written some of the best analyses of the wastefulness of the U.S. healthcare finance system and some of the best advocacy for a single-payer scheme. Steffi Wohlhandler. Welcome, Steffi. So there's now a lot of controversy about Sanders' single-payer plan. Hillary people are trying to stoke up a lot of anxiety and uncertainty about it. First of all, have you gotten a chance to look at any of Sanders' specific proposals before we talk more generally about the idea?
Well, I read the memo that came out from his campaign a couple of days ago. I'm also familiar with Sanders' bills that he has introduced into the Senate, which are about setting up state-based single-payer plans. What he was proposing the other night sounds much more like a federal single-payer plan, really a Medicare for All type of system.
What kind of plans has he introduced himself, and how do they differ from the more familiar Medicare for All? Was that S-676?
The plans he introduced himself were for state-based demonstrations of single-payer. Many people feel that you want to do a state-based single-payer as a springboard to a national program. I'm somewhat sympathetic to that view, but indeed what he was saying the other night was a national program, a Medicare for All. So even though the structures are pretty similar, the scale of what he was talking about the other night is national rather than state demonstration.
And I think some people are tarring him because the proposal to bring single payer to Vermont failed miserably. And since he's from Vermont, this is somehow passes judgment on the whole idea. What do you know about the Vermont scheme?
Well, the Vermont plan was never a true single payer. I guess they were talking about it as a path to single payer. And the Governor Shumlin had been elected in 2010 on a promise that he would develop some sort of single-payer plan. But what he developed was a hybrid, which turned out was going to be very expensive because multi-payer plans are much more expensive than single-payer plans, largely because they have much higher administrative costs. So Shumlin was politically weakened in an election, and then he backed off. Now, that's not Sanders. Sanders is obviously a senator. He's not the governor of Vermont, and I don't think that the situation in Vermont says much about the possibilities for a national plan.
Now, we've got Hillary and her surrogates sounding alarms about how Sanders' single-payer plan would take away health care from people, which is very bizarre, but is there any reason to believe any word that this sort of these scare tactics?
The idea of taking away health care is a complete falsehood, and Hillary's people know that. To give people a better health plan is not taking anything away, it's adding. And Hillary is very familiar with single payer. She's obviously very familiar with health care debate in general, and has actually said that she supports a Medicare for All. Like many Democrats, I would say almost universal among Democrats, she has said in the past a single payer would be a good thing, but we just can't get there. That's sort of the common thing among the Democrats. You know, single payer is my first preference, but we just can't get there. So for her to say that it's a takeaway is not true, and in fact, I think she and her surrogates know that's not true.
This idea that we just can't get there, I mean, it's a very strange notion of politics that you just only propose things you know could be enacted the day after tomorrow. But what about those political obstacles? Are they as formidable as people claim they are?
In order to get a change like a single-payer plan, you're going to need a political movement. We had a civil rights movement, and that's why we have the level of at least formal equality that we do. Many of us were alive before there was a civil rights movement and lived in a segregated society, and it looked like things would never change. But in fact, the movement can change things. People can change history, and that's actually what we're talking about, is building a political movement for single payer. Not as hard as you think it might be, because many, many people are profoundly unhappy with the current healthcare system. It's not only the 30-plus million uninsured people who are unhappy, but many people with private insurance think it's pretty good until they go and try to use the insurance. And then find out that there's co-payments, there's deductibles, there's uncovered services. They're in a narrow network, Many of these narrow network insurance plans won't even let you go to a cancer center, even if it's medically necessary. They won't let you go to an academic medical center, even if it's medically needed. Many people, over time, more and more people are going to see that the healthcare system isn't working for them. So I do think there's a real possibility of building the political movement we need to get single payer, and that does involve unseating the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry. You've got to get rid of the insurance industry because their overhead and profit and the administrative burden that they place on doctors and hospitals is costing us nearly a third of every healthcare dollar. And in order to get an affordable universal plan, you're going to have to get rid of them.
I do want to get back to that issue of the administrative overhead, but what is the relation of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, to this increased cost shifting that we're seeing, that the shift of coinsurance and higher deductibles, higher copays? Did the act itself encourage that, discourage that, any relation at all, or is this a trend that's been underway for so long that the act didn't really change all that much?
It has been underway for a while, but what Obamacare did was it sort of the government stamp of approval on skimpy health care plans. So the plans offered through the exchanges are actually very, very skimpy. The bronze plan, which can cost you about $6,000 a year in premiums in New York State, comes with a deductible in many areas, comes with a deductible of another $5,000 to $6,000. So you're out of pocket by about $12,000 before your insurance pays even a penny of your health care costs. And even those plans often have very narrow networks, and if you had a serious disease that required you to go to, for instance, academic medical center or cancer center, you'd have additional out-of-pocket costs that don't even count towards your out-of-pocket maximum. So the coverage is very skimpy on the exchanges, and this is something new for government because in the past, when government intervened on the issue of coverage, it was always to intervene and say, oh, we have to have more extensive coverage, and you have to cover fertility services, or you have to cover a reasonable amount of care. And for the government to put a stamp of approval on a very skimpy plan like those bronze plans was actually a very bad thing in terms of encouraging skimpier and skimpier insurance from everyone, from employers and from the exchanges.
Even our silver plan doesn't seem like much of a bargain, really.
No, the silver plans only cover about 70% of expected health care costs, leaving the enrollee responsible for about 30% on average of health care costs. They're a little better than the bronze plans that cover only 60% of expected costs, leaving the patient responsible for about 40%. But it's very skimpy indeed, and skimpier than what people traditionally had through their employer-sponsored coverage, and obviously much skimpier than coverage in a place like Canada, where all medically necessary cares have covered 100%.
All right, now let's talk some about the economics of a single-payer plan. The overhead, you said earlier, is about 30% of our healthcare spending. How does that come to be, and how does that compare with, say, a Canadian model?
The overhead has several major components. A big one, which is obvious, is just the insurance overhead, the money that you pay in premiums to the insurance company, but that they never pay out to a doctor or a hospital or even a drug company, the money that they just keep in their own building and use for their own administrative costs and profit. That's one component of it. But the hospitals and doctors also have huge administrative costs because they have to deal with thousands of different insurance products, send out the bills for those insurance products, send out bills for copayments, deductibles for individual payment patients. So sort of the mirror image of those high administrative costs in the insurance industry is the high administrative costs that doctors and hospitals have. In Canada, a hospital is paid on a lump sum basis, like we pay for a fire department. They negotiate an annual budget, and 1/12 of that budget is deposited in their bank account every month. So a Canadian hospital runs for administrative costs less than half of the administrative costs in the United States. So when you add that all up together, the insurance administration, the hospital administration, the doctor's administration, a few smaller categories, it turns out that 31% of every healthcare dollar goes for administration. that goes just for paperwork and bureaucracy. And in contrast, in a place like Canada, about 16% of healthcare dollars go for administration, meaning that you would free up 15% of the total U.S. healthcare budget by changing the payment system to a simple single-payer system. 15% of healthcare budget in the United States is a huge amount of money. It's more than $450 billion, and that turns annually. $450 billion is actually enough to cover all of the uninsured, but also improve the coverage of people who now have these skimpy exchange plans or skimpy plans through their employers with high copayments and deductibles. So that's the beauty of single payer. It pays for itself through the administrative simplification. And for that reason, it's actually very good economics, not just very good medical.
Now, a lot of economists and politicians who are sympathetic to the ACA say that it's essential that patients have some skin in the game. I believe Hillary has even said that herself, that we can't have people just go to the doctor for free because that would mean that they'd overconsume healthcare services. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that's a silly idea. When somebody's sick, their entire skin is in the game. They're not spending money frivolously. They're spending money because they think it'll improve their health. And, you know, sometimes people are mistaken and think something's going to improve their health that won't, and we need to be educating them about that and not providing useless or harmful care. But this idea that, somehow patients are abusing the healthcare system by going to healthcare too much, I don't think it holds water. You know, I'm a primary care doctor, and I think about the things I do in my office. I order mammograms. I send people for colonoscopies. And, you know, no one in their right mind would do that for any other reason other than to improve their health. It's not fun consumption. It's actually people are there because they want better health. So I'm just not a believer in the skin in the game idea. I know that it is, we know from the literature that it's very punitive toward poor people. A rich person doesn't actually care about a $50 copayment. A poor person might be afraid to go to the doctor with a $5 copayment. So, and again, that's not just speculation. There's data on that, that copayments and deductibles are particularly harmful for people who have low incomes and particularly harmful for people with chronic illnesses, who may need to go to the doctor 20 times a year, 30 times a year if you're seriously ill. And $5 or even or particularly $50 each time you go is going to be quite punitive. So I'm not a believer in skin in the game. I don't think there's any evidence that we need that in order to control costs. Certainly Canada does not charge copayments or deductibles for covered services. In Scotland, where they have a single-payer system, absolutely everything is covered, including they have free parking at the hospital, you know, because they say, yeah, you didn't want to get sick, and just because you have to go to the hospital doesn't mean you should pay for parking. In Scotland, they say that we view the patients not as consumers of healthcare, but as owners of the healthcare system. And that's what we need to be working toward in the United States, viewing the healthcare system as a public service and making sure that, people have the access to care that they need.
I'm speaking with Stephanie Wohlhandler, who is a primary care physician, a professor at Hunter College, City University of New York, and a co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. Now, we talk a lot about single payer, which is inspired, I guess, by Canada, which is not only our neighbor, but like us in many ways, so it makes sense that people might look to Canada as a model. But it's not the only way of doing healthcare, right? We have, you know, the British model, which is entirely nationalized. And then Germany and the Netherlands, they do different things. So could you talk about some of the other models for healthcare provision besides ours and Canada's?
Canada's a single-payer national health insurance model with the insurance is fully socialized, the insurance is public, but the ownership of a lot of hospitals is nonprofit and doctor's offices are private. There's many of them privately owned. So it's a private delivery system, but a public insurance model. Scotland is different. Scotland has a traditional national health service model where the government owns the hospital and employs the doctors and nurses. And that model seems to be very popular in Scotland and work very well as well. Places like France have something of a hybrid model. The government guarantees universal health care. They require small copayments when you go to to see a doctor. The thing that they do in France is that the government really controls the hospitals because the government pays for most hospitals through direct grants. A lot of the hospitals are, in fact, public. So there's a lot of government control of the hospital side of the system, but sort of more flexibility on the doctor side in terms of the way the doctors are paid. Germany, people tend to talk about Germany some and say, well, they have private insurance. That's not exactly true. The German system is based on these sickness funds that are jointly managed by unions and employers. And because Germany's almost fully unionized, that model makes sense. In a situation like the United States, where there's very few unions outside of the public sector, it's not really realistic to say we're going to have a system-based joint union management sickness fund. In Germany, again, the government has a lot of control over the hospital system, with much of the hospital capital funding coming from direct grants from the so-called Länder, which are equivalent to our states. So there's a lot of different models. However, the other developed countries all have universal system with the government playing the role of assuring universality, and the government also exercising much more control over the hospital, so largely through control of hospital capital.
One thing we didn't mention, though, that the American system is very poor at cost control, right? The Canadians really have a much more effective system of keeping medical inflation under control.
All other developed nations have a more effective system of keeping costs under control. The United States will spend almost $10,000 per capita this year on health care costs, which is nearly double the average for other developed nations. Other developed nations in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Those are the nations we would compare ourselves to. So the U.S. has the worst record in terms of cost control anywhere in the world. You know, we can talk some about those costs, the ways costs are controlled in other countries, if you'd like.
Yeah, since we're talking about the Canadian inspiration here, how do they do it there?
They do have much lower administrative costs, so that's one thing. They save about 15% of spending relative to the United States by their lower administrative costs. They also have a very effective health planning, which is implemented through the control of hospital capital. So whereas in the United States, a hospital can just decide, you know, we can make money in, you know, Greenwich, Connecticut. We'll open up offices there. We can make money on the east side of Manhattan. We'll put a new hospital there. The situation in the United States is each hospital or institution makes its own decisions about whether to expand based largely on profitability, whether they're going to be able to make money or not. In Canada, that's not the way it goes. In Canada, a hospital gets a lump sum operating budget from the province, but that's just to cover operating expense. If they want to expand, build a new hospital or put in an expensive new piece of equipment, they have to go to the province and ask for a separate capital budget. So capital is budgeted separately by the province, which means that the provincial health planners have a lot of control over whether hospitals expand. And that means that hospitals and facilities are more likely to be placed where they're needed and not be placed where they're redundant and actually add to cost. I'm not going to imply that this is an easy process, because a hospital comes and says, you know, we need a new wing. We need to agitate and get the province to pay for that new wing. And so there's an intense political debate about the expansion of hospitals. And hospitals frequently win that debate and, you know, get a new operating room or a new wing. But sometimes they lose, and it means that you're actually making explicit public decisions about where hospitals expand and where they don't.
Now let's talk specifically some about the single-payer proposals here. We got Medicare. It's very well established. It's been around for 50 years. It's very popular. Everybody knows how it works. How difficult would it be to expand that to the entire population?
The good news about Medicare is we know that it's legal. Expanding it to the entire population would not open up a program to Supreme Court challenges the way the Affordable Care Act was opened. So Medicare could legally be expanded to the entire population. It would be important to think about this as the traditional Medicare model where the government's actually paying the bills. You may be familiar with the so-called Medicare Advantage plans where private insurance companies come in and sort of subcontract to set up HMOs under Medicare. That model, I think, is not very good. It's inflationary and it wastes money. But the traditional Medicare program can and should be extended to all Americans. It also needs to be improved because there are gaps in Medicare coverage that a real single-payer program ought to pay for all medically necessary care and not leave all those gaps.
And what about the proposals that are floating around, whether it's Sanders or others who are in Congress? Piece in the New York Times on Wednesday as we record this, about making it sound like it's a great mystery. Is it really a great mystery?
No. I think that single-payer plans are actually fairly well-known. They've been supported by Sanders. They've been supported by congressmen in H.R. 676. There's proposals out there from Physicians for a National Health Program, which I co-founded some years ago, that appeared in New England Journal and the JAMA. There's the Canadian model, which is actually very well-studied and well-known in the United States. So I thought Margot Sanger-Katz writing in the New York Times was a little bit strange that she seemed to think that there was some mystery about what single-payer really meant. But that was her argument, I guess.
It would seem that the obstacles to having a single-payer plan are more political than they are technical. Isn't that true?
Oh, absolutely. And many of the technical kinks have been worked out in other countries. Canada has a lot of experience with making a single-payer plan work. You know, they call their plan Medicare. They have the same name as we do. But, of course, it is universal, and they've struggled to contain costs, but they've been much more successful than the United States.
So what would a transition look like? Would we see the euthanasia of the insurance companies?
A transition? Well, we went through one transition already with the beginning of Medicare. About half of the senior citizens, 1965, before the passage of Medicare, about half of senior citizens did have insurance, almost all of it private insurance. So we've already done that transition once, so we could do it again. Mail everybody an insurance card, and you can use the Social Security system to sign up everyone involved in Social Security. The Social Security knows where you are, they know what you earn, they know how old you are, and that, in fact, was what was done with the Medicare program. A postcard was mailed out to everybody within the Social Security system, and then people were recruited in poor communities to track down folks who were not part of the Social Security system, who were 65 or over, and then agricultural agents and forestry officials were also recruited to go track people down who might be eligible for Medicare but not within the Social Security system. It wasn't that hard. They managed to enroll under Medicare. They managed to enroll 19 million seniors into Medicare in about 11 months. So more than 99% of people were enrolled in less than a year. And they started paying the first checks from the Medicare program 11 months after Lyndon Johnson signed it. So the there's not a problem with a technical transition. You're correct in saying, obviously, there's a political fight that one has to do. But the technical side of the transition is straightforward, and we've already been through it once under Medicare.
Now, Clinton is trying to use the threat of tax increases to cast a pall over Sanders' proposals. Net spending would decline, right? So the selling point of single-payer is that we could cover everyone with many fewer restrictions on coverage for those who are covered, and at the same time we'd probably save some money. Is that the way you see the broad economics of it?
Yes, that is the economics. You do have to capture current private payments for health care into a revenue stream for the single payer. So currently employers spend, quite a bit of money on employer-sponsored coverage. You need to recapture that as a tax. I think Sanders is saying he would do a payroll tax. And then the private payments that people are making out of pocket, you need to capture that as a tax. And in the first year, we think single payer would cost about the same as what we're currently spending. You wouldn't have big savings in the first year. But over time, the better cost containment of a single-payer system would save money for all Americans.
That was Steffi Wohlhandler, a primary care physician, professor at City University of New York, and co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the third movement of Beethoven's String Quartet No. 14, a song of thanksgiving after recovery from a long illness, performed by the Yale Quartet. Till next week, bye.